I wish to God you protected the White House like you're protecting your reputation here today.
It's not just about losing faith in the Secret Service, but losing faith in everything. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Rumors, turbocharged by the internet, often get reported as fact. But when the truth emerges, do news outlets right their wrongs?
Only about 2% of articles that had an error were ever corrected.
And a writer frustrated with what he sees as a religion-saturated culture publishes an atheist tome for kids.
I sometimes think there is no boss, that most things happen just because. Murphy, though, does not agree. He sits around and worships me.
Murphy's a D-O-G.
More coming up.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. POTUS, we have a problem.
The director of the Secret Service has just resigned. Members of Congress from both parties had been calling for Julia Pearson to step down or be fired after a string of security breaches.
This time, the Secret Service is in the woodshed after a man with a knife jumped the White House fence and made it all the way to the East Room. That followed an incident at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta when a man with a criminal record and a gun joined the president in an elevator. Congress withered Secret Service Chief Pearson with a rare bipartisan blast.
I wish to God you protected the White House like you're protecting your reputation here today.
An internal investigation is not sufficient. I repeat, is not sufficient.
Let me be frank. I believe that you have done a disservice to the President of the United States.
The Secret Service did that?
Protect the man. Protect the symbol. Protect the office. This is the mandate of the U.S. Secret Service.
The Secret Service has not always been a perfect institution, but this, I think, has really shaken people.
Chris Saliza writes the Washington Post political blog The Fix. He says that the outrage over this story is about more than a fence jumper or even a gun-toting elevator rider.
When what you think of as infallible is shown to be quite fallible, very human, I think it does lend to a pretty basic question, which is, if the President of the United States can't be adequately protected, what does that mean for me?
Or for David Letterman?
Well, I tell you what's frightening, because as a kid, you believe that certain things are unassailable. And at the top of the list would be protection for the president.
Right.
And now to learn that it's like Costco security guards. And no offense, I mean, it's a real eye-opener. You think, what really do we have left that we can believe in unqualified?
Certainly, the Secret Service is not unassailable. It was created by Abraham Lincoln on the day he died to track down counterfeiters in the wake of the Civil War. It didn't get into presidential protection until after President McKinley was shot. Since then, we've had one president killed, two shot, and several intruded upon.
FDR was watching a movie one night, and the lights come up, and there's a stranger standing next to him in his house.
Peter Baker is the New York Times White House correspondent.
Teddy Roosevelt, is told that somebody's come to see him, has an appointment, Mr. John Smith. He agrees to see him and then quickly realizes he doesn't know this guy and he's kind of a problem. And he tells the usher, take this crank out of here. And he did have a gun in the back pocket. Truman was living across the street from the White House in Blair House because the main White House was being renovated. And that's when these Puerto Rican terrorists burst through the doors trying to kill him. And there was a gunfight and one of them died and one of the Secret Service officers died. Well, in recent years, you had a man who thought he was the Messiah who crashed his Chevy Impala through the gate, made it all the way up to the North Portico.
That is the car I think the Messiah would drive.
That exactly. Well, a modest Messiah. And you had a guy who stole a private, Army private, who stole a helicopter from Fort Meade, flew it onto the lawn of the White House. You had a guy who had a Cessna, and he crashed into the White House.
But Hollywood tells a different story, depicting the FBI, CIA, NSA, and certainly the Secret Service as pretty much invincible, for better or for worse, but supremely competent.
you take the NSA, you take the FBI, you take the CIA, and you take the Secret Service, all sort of these pillars of what we believe to be hyper-competence in our society. And they have all at one level or another in recent years. Some of that hyper-competence has been called into question.
Chris Saliza.
What TV and movies make of it will in some way determine in 10 years, if we have this conversation, do we have a different image of the sort of the caretaker class than we did today?
By caretakers, Saliza doesn't refer to the Secret Service agents assigned to the retired First Lady buying peas in the movie Guarding Tess. But he could have been.
They're on special today, 2 for $59.
They're on special today, 2 for $59.
Copy that. It's 2 for $59.
But I only want one.
Roger that, Doug, but she only wants one.
How much for just one? The same. It's a 2 for $1 thing.
Bobby, it's a 2 for $1 thing, so I suggest you go ahead and get both.
Copy that, Doug, but I believe we've lost interest in peas. Repeat, lost interest in peas.
Dan Emmett has served 3 presidents as Secret Service protection. I asked him what his favorite Hollywood depiction is.
It would be Clint Eastwood's movie, In the Line of Fire.
Why?
Because he was miserable when he was working a lot of the time. He was sick. He was not feeling well.
This guy's going to make a try. I've got to come back, Sam. Frank, and your age.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States!
Do you really have the guts to take a bullet, Frank?
Gun!
There's no such thing as a sick day on the President's detail. You're expected to be there because you have a shift that's counting on you. So that's very authentic. That's very true.
But I think the image is closer to that impassive, almost inhumanly strong individual who is trained to serve as literally a human shield. What do you think the current news cycle is doing to that image?
It's not doing it any good. I can tell you that. One of the Secret Service's biggest assets has always been its mystique. And so the more you're in the media in a negative fashion, of course, the worse it becomes. And our enemies look at that and they go, well, you know, these guys aren't supermen. They're just like everybody else, maybe. They make mistakes. They have human frailties. And perhaps we could capitalize on that. So it's not good for the mission.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
I see you standing over the grave of another dead president.
That's not going to happen.
There are always fence jumpers at the White House. You can't have a walled fortress in the middle of the capital of the world's paramount democracy. But one got inside the White House. That's frightening on its face. But it also evokes in this dreary news season a feeling widely shared that, as Yeats once wrote, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. The president himself noted in a July fundraiser, no less, that, quote, part of the people's concern is just the sense that around the world, the old order isn't holding. Chris Saliza.
I think the hardest thing for him and for any politician, for all of us, is we don't have a new set of sort of foundational principles of institutions that we feel like we can rely on. And I think there's a worry that we may never. And that's sort of the most deep-seated, but potentially the most sort of unnerving anxiety.
In the meantime, there is a temporary remedy, denial, as employed with a practiced flourish by Glenn Beck after Secret Service agents on an official trip to Colombia were caught wrangling with prostitutes over money.
Sorry, don't believe it. Someone is either intentionally making them look incompetent or they're being set up, foreign or domestic. Ooh, wait a minute, foreign.
He blames Putin, something we all can rely on. Send in the, Marines?
Coming up, running down old rumors and shiny new ones.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here are just a few of the rumors snowballing through the press recently.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in the hospital because he's so heavy, his ankles have fractured under his own weight.
It turns out the man who jumped the White House fence and made it inside the executive mansion got much further than originally thought.
A massage therapist had surgery to add an additional third breast in the hopes of becoming a reality TV star.
We all know that rumors flare in unpredictable directions and are notoriously hard to corral, but the claims you just heard, and many others, are being monitored on a new site called Emergent.info. Emergent has three rankings for rumors: unverified, which applies to Kim Jong-un's ankles, confirmed true, which applies to the White House intruder, and confirmed false, that would be the woman with the third breast. Craig Silverman created Emergent, inspired by his years chronicling media misinformation on his blog, Regret the Error.
I see a lot of stuff that gets reported that you might argue never should have made it into the press. What I realized is that there's so much information that gets out there and that you can't pretend to put a lid on.
You can't ignore the fact that it's out there. You have to deal with it one way or another.
That's it. And I think obviously one of the reasons why news organizations are picking these things up is that they see a spike with traffic. So that motivation is a part of it. And then I think there's also a conundrum for journalists. Today, a lot of this stuff starts on social networks that maybe in the past they would have had a crack at trying to verify before it actually got out in wide distribution. So that's a new challenge. If we're going to deal with it at this early stage, how do we do that in a way that creates understanding rather than creates confusion?
Okay, so if the cart of bad information is put before the horse of the media, why? Let's talk about why people start rumors.
There's about a century or so of research into rumors. And at the core of it is that when we have situations where there's a level of uncertainty, and particularly where there's a level of anxiety, in the absence of real information, we sort of tend to process and invent new information. It's been shown that we're more likely to share information if we feel it has kind of an urgent nature to it. So in situations of natural disasters or crisis, I mean, we're seeing lots of rumors around ISIS, people are more inclined to pass on information because they think it's really important for people to know it.
But you also note that often the most shared rumors are pretty absurd. I mean, the claim of the Florida woman with her third breast was shared over 400,000 times. Compare that with the claim that ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was killed by a U.S. airstrike, also untrue. It was only shared about 29,000 times. It suggests that we really mine these rumors for their entertainment value.
There's absolutely an emotional connection.
A third breast?
People might share it and say, you know, can you believe this? Or look at what's happening to the youth today. You could imagine different viewpoints being grafted onto this fake story. There are dynamics of just sharing in general. You mix them with things that have been designed to attract attention, and they tend to be rewarded with social shares. There's even been research that suggests in a lot of cases people don't even read what they share. They see the headline or the tweet and on it goes.
Do we think that we're actually better at sussing out rumors than we really are?
The short answer is yes. I think the average person thinks that they evaluate in a very reasoned way. And again, research tells us that that's usually not the case. If it's something that conforms with our pre-existing beliefs or something that we want to be a certain way, then we're more inclined to go along with it. Things that challenge what we think, we actually tend to double down on our pre-existing beliefs.
In addition to tracking the rumors, you also track the changes to the story. What have you noticed about how news organizations deal with making corrections?
You know, the best data we have about corrections from a newspaper study is that only about 2% of articles that had an error were ever corrected. We overall don't see a huge amount of updates being made.
But there are news organizations that are more willing to concede they've made a mistake than others.
Absolutely. Certainly there are some places that have a culture of correction to them. One that does come to mind would be the New York Times. They've committed a resource that I can't think of anyone else who has, which is that they have a senior editor whose almost his sole responsibility is dealing with requests for correction. But what we see with a lot of these stories, which are, you know, stories that are spreading online, is that rather than calling it a correction or admitting they got something wrong, they're usually just sort of updating and say, oh, hey, it turned out to be a hoax. And I don't see a lot of evidence that once this new information comes out, they actually make an effort to get it reshared and to recirculate it.
Is that because the news outlets don't try, or is because people just don't have the same interest in sharing a correction to a story?
There's certainly an element where the lie is much more attractive and much more shareable than the debunking of it.
How do news organizations make the truth more shareable?
I don't know yet. Hopefully, towards the end of the year, we're going to be able to analyze the debunkings that generated some engagement and some interest and see if there's anything that connects them. And it's kind of shameful to think that, you know, we don't have a body of evidence or a body of research to draw on already. What we do have is some research that talks about ways to get past some of the bias that people have. And advice for that are things like trying to find neutral sources who appeal to people from, you know, both sides of an issue or a particular side of an issue, who can express the debunking rather than just putting it in the voice of the news organization.
Can you give me an example of that?
A really good example of that would be what happened when Barack Obama and John McCain were both running for president. There were, of course, you know, a persistent rumor, a persistent lie that Barack Obama was a Muslim. And at one of the events where John McCain was doing a town hall, a woman stood up and she described Barack Obama as a Muslim. And John McCain actually said to her very clearly that, no, he's not. He's a Christian. And so out of all of the attempts by the Obama campaign and by everyone else to convince people that Barack Obama is a Christian, I would argue that that was probably the most effective.
Wow. I don't see that happening a lot.
No, you don't.
Craig, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is a fellow at the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia and founder of Emergent.info, a real-time rumor tracking tool.
Rumors don't have to be true to generate a reaction. They merely have to sound plausible. In 1996, the San Jose Mercury News published a three-part series by Gary Webb linking the Nicaraguan Civil War, the CIA, and most shockingly, the 80s crack epidemic in America's inner cities. Webb's story went like this. Back in the 80s, the CIA propped up a group of right-wing Contras dedicated to overthrowing the leftist Sandinista government of Nicaragua. The Contras financed their revolution by selling huge amounts of cocaine to U.S. traffickers who refined it into the crack sold by Los Angeles gangs in black neighborhoods. The series fed a pre-existing narrative of African Americans being targeted by the government and thus erupted a firestorm.
What you found here, Gary, is a monster.
You have no idea what you're getting into.
You really tell me that I should just walk away from this?
You'd be an idiot not to.
That's from a movie out later this month about Gary Webb titled Kill the Messenger, which documents what happened next. A widespread effort, ultimately successful, to discredit Webb and his reporting, powered by an unusual collaboration between major news organizations and the CIA. Now a declassified CIA report, unearthed by The Intercept's Ryan Devereaux, documents the agency's efforts to contain its public relations nightmare.
As Gary Webb would say, in the years that followed, he never believed that there was a vast sort of CIA conspiracy to undermine and destroy black communities through the introduction of crack cocaine. But the lead of his story could leave one with that impression, especially coupled with the art that accompanied the piece, which had a sort of CIA logo with the man smoking crack combined together. And so the CIA is freaking out about what's going on. They immediately start working with reporters. They're briefing former CIA officers who are speaking to the media about the story. They're even, as this document notes, sort of breaking some of their own rules in commenting on whether or not specific individual people have had relationships to the Central Intelligence Agency. So in short, what the CIA did was watch with relief as the biggest papers in the country just ravenously attacked the San Jose Mercury News and went after Gary Webb.
Why were the other major press so eager to discredit Webb? Is it because Webb's reporting was so wanting? Or is it just because they got scooped, or is there some other explanation?
I think that there's a lot of credibility to the explanation that the LA Times was scooped in its own backyard by a smaller competitor paper. This regional newspaper had basically found this amazing story and run with it in this three-part investigation. Webb's story had a whole cast of characters and a lot of moving parts, and it was very complicated. But the LA Times, 2 years before his story came out, had run a piece by reporter Jesse Katz on a drug dealer named Freeway Rick Ross, and sort of detailing how Rick Ross was this, you know, enormous figure in Los Angeles drug trafficking. 2 years later, Rick Ross appears as a central figure in Webb's reporting. Katz returned to his examination of Rick Ross, and it was sort of strange turn of events, published a story responding to Webb's piece that actually downplayed the significance of Ross as a player in the South Central Los Angeles drug scene. Instead of attempting to advance the story, they tried to destroy a competitor paper and an award-winning investigative journalist.
Now, there were 17 reporters who participated in the debunking process. I assume most or all of them are alive. Have you had a chance to talk to them to find out what was going on, what their motivations were?
Author and journalist Nick Scow, who wrote the book Kill the Messenger, interviewed Jesse Katz. And in 2013, Katz expressed some serious regret over the way this whole thing played out. So I do think, in hindsight, it definitely seems that at least some of the journalists that were involved in this process feel that it was over the top.
Intelligence reporting is a bit of a dance. You, the reporter, never tell the intelligence agency exactly what you have, and they certainly never tell you but the very bare minimum of what they think they can disclose. In this case, you're saying that the PR strategy was for the CIA to win the trust of these otherwise skeptical reporters by giving them information and access that the reporters normally wouldn't get, kind of ingratiating themselves. Is that what took place?
What the document suggests is that they were working with a ground base of journalists that they already trusted. And when these journalists approached them with an interest in attacking Webb's story, which may have been a way to approach the CIA, hey, I'm interested in sort of attacking this thing that you're drawing a lot of heat for. Why don't you give me information? It could have played out like that. And then the CIA was more than willing to speak to some of these reporters and sort of cross lines that it doesn't normally cross in addressing very specific things. And the media was more than happy to take these anonymous CIA quotes and run with them.
And how successful were they? What was the effect on Webb's reputation and his career?
I mean, it's complicated. There were a lot of deep dives into Webb's reporting, and credible reporters did find holes in the reporting.
For instance, there's not a whole lot of evidence that Gary Webb contacted the CIA for comment, although he said later that there were unreturned phone calls. It never comes up in any of the three pieces he wrote, which is a huge red flag, is it not?
It's pretty much standard practice to reach out to the agencies that are, you know, in question when you're making bold claims about a particular agency. And in Scow's biography of Webb, he also quotes a staffer at the San Jose Mercury News that says that Webb didn't reach out to the CIA for comment because Webb felt that it was sort of useless to reach out to the CIA for comment on something that they were obviously not going to give him any information on.
Were there other significant gaping holes in the story that these news organizations did locate?
The most substantive criticisms that were leveled at Webb were that his story relied heavily on three convicted drug dealers as sources, and some inconsistencies in the timelines that at least one of these individuals that he was focusing on presented. The other concerns centered around two words in the lead of his story, which was that millions of dollars were involved in this drug ring, and tons of cocaine were being peddled in the streets of South Central LA. And reporting that followed in the story didn't seem to support those claims.
As the other media focused on his reporting, what happened to him and his career?
He was discredited. His paper was discredited. He tendered resignation at the San Jose Mercury News, sort of moved about in the years that followed, but was never, ever able to recover the credibility that he lost as a result of the attack on his reporting. His depression, which some of his friends and coworkers suspect was present throughout his life, really intensified. his family and friends sort of watched him spiral downward until he took his own life in 2004.
What ultimately do you think is the legacy of Gary Webb's reporting, the legacy of dark alliances?
The CIA internal reviews of their own operations revealed that for more than a decade, the CIA was not reporting its assets involvement in drug trafficking. This is during the Just Say No period when Americans are being told that drugs are the absolute worst thing in the world, terrible, terrible scourge. Meanwhile, the CIA is completely turning a blind eye to its proxy armies who are involved in drug trafficking. I think that without his reporting, you know, those revelations would never have emerged. He felt the war on drugs was a total hypocrisy. In his original structuring of the story, that was the narrative that he really intended to drive home. Disparities in crack cocaine sentencing, along racial lines. He was truly ahead of his time in targeting the war on drugs as a real important social issue that needs critical examination. And I think he rightly earned a place among journalists who try to tell those stories and report on those stories as a legendary, important figure.
All right, Ryan, thank you.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Ryan Devereaux is a reporter for The Intercept. News stories seldom have clear-cut heroes and villains. So when a convincing good guy, bad guy story does come along, it's hard not to indulge in its dramatic simplicity. One such emerged from the Ecuadorian jungle in 1993. Oil giant Texaco, now Chevron, mined the native land for oil, generating oceans of profit. Then, after depleting the rainforest, the story goes, it left behind tons of refuse and pits of flowing byproducts that poisoned water supplies and sickened the residents. The media went wild for this tale of corporate greed and negligence. Here's a 60 Minutes report from 2009.
The Sequoias took us to their community hut, where we saw the driving force behind the suit. Stephen Donziger, a New York lawyer, far from home.
These are people who never believed they had a right to sue an American company in their own court system.
Stephen Donziger, a charismatic Harvard-educated lawyer, led the charge against Chevron, first by bringing suit against Texaco in 1993, and finally by winning a $19 billion judgment against Chevron in an Ecuadorian court. However, that happy ending quickly unraveled. This March, a U.S. District Court in New York found that Donziger had forged documents, coerced judges, and fabricated evidence. Last week, a federal appeals court in Virginia ruled that Donziger's lawyers must reveal more confidential documents which could hold new information about wrongdoing. How Donziger may have strayed from the path of good intentions to his current predicament is the subject of Paul M. Barrett's new book, Law of the Jungle. Barrett says Donziger's most effective strategy was to offer the media a morality play.
Donziger, at the outset, would use imagery and classic themes, the little guy against the big guy, David versus Goliath, that became very appealing to the media.
Yeah, from a PR point of view, it was like shooting fish in a toxic sludge pit. Big bad oil company, benighted indigenous peoples, and
the knight on the white horse who's going to use the rule of law to speak truth to power, to hold the big company accountable on behalf of the little people.
Tell me who all got involved in this case, and tell me to what degree they were kind of suckered.
Well, he certainly was extremely deft in bringing world-class celebrities into the picture. He began with Bianca Jagger, the ex-wife of Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones, who's a very well-known human rights advocate. He was successful in charming very prominent journalists like William Languishet, who wrote a very celebrated piece for Vanity Fair in 2007 that echoed all of the themes that Donziger wanted echoed in terms of evil corporate power. That Vanity Fair piece, in turn, very much impressed Trudy Styler, the movie producer and wife of Sting. Trudy Styler then in turn became basically the star of a documentary film done by Joe Berlinger, a very prominent documentary filmmaker. The film is called Crude. It was released in 2009, shown at Sundance. The New York Times gave it rave reviews. There's a scene early on in the movie that's vintage Danziger, where Danziger is ranting and raving at one of the oil company lawyers, shouting at him over and over again, calling him auto corrupto. Chevron, meanwhile, was investigating him personally, trying to turn the case into his conduct and a question of his ethics. And Chevron went to the courts in the United States and said, toward that end, we'd like to see basically the field tapes from this documentary. And they got a sympathetic federal court in New York to rule that they could have hundreds of hours of raw tape. And you could hear everything they said and did while working in Ecuador about how the facts don't really matter. All that matters is power and scaring the judges.
And the only language that I believe this judge is going to understand is one of pressure, intimidation, and humiliation. And that's what we're doing today. We're going to let him know what time it is.
Danziger had made the fatal mistake for a lawyer of forgetting that he was not the subject of a movie, and he had allowed the documentarians to follow him around, and what they recorded was very damning.
He asserted a journalistic privilege that the outtakes were nobody else's business, but the court said, oh no, they are our business, because this was not, in the end, journalism. It was propaganda. You had too much influence on the production of this film for you to claim that journalism has taken place.
That's exactly right.
With his self-indicting statements, Chevron lawyers did what?
They were able to establish that Danziger had relationships with supposedly neutral court officials. Chevron used that evidence on film as leverage to persuade the judge to give them further access to all of Danziger's personal files, his email, the files on his computer hard drive. And in there was really the huge mother load of evidence that he had behaved not so much as a litigator as something closer to an extortionist.
Yeah, that the plaintiffs had essentially ghostwritten the ostensibly independent environmental report outlining the scope of the damages to the Ecuadorian jungle.
That's right.
And the suggestion that $18 billion would be a satisfactory award was crafted entirely by the plaintiffs.
This was done by a U.S.-based consulting firm, PhDs, who do this kind of work. That's all fine. But if they are going to provide the court with information, they're supposed to do it in public filings that the other side can respond to. And here they did it secretly. And more than that, once they were caught, the experts who Danziger was relying on disavowed their scientific work. They said, we're ashamed of what we did. Chevron had sued them too, and they walked away from it. On top of all of that, Chevron was able to put together evidence that persuaded the judge in New York that Danziger's team had ghostwritten not just this report on damages, but had ghostwritten portions of the final judgment itself. The point is not that this shows there wasn't pollution. There was pollution. The point was that the processes of the law that were supposed to hold Chevron accountable had been corrupted, and therefore it made it very difficult to take the pollution case seriously.
There are, however, judgments in this case. One was from the Ecuadorian court, in spite of all of these legal machinations against Chevron. And the other was in New York against Danziger himself. Tell me where these judgments stand.
As far as Ecuador is concerned, Danziger, on behalf of his clients, has a legitimate verdict. The actual damage amount has been reduced in subsequent months. It's now worth only about $9.5 billion, but that still ain't chump change. The problem is that Chevron said, this is a fraudulent verdict. We're not going to pay a dime. And Chevron has no assets in Ecuador. So Ecuador is not able, in and of itself, to force Chevron to pay anything. Meanwhile, up in New York, Chevron succeeded this past March in winning a verdict under the American racketeering law, finding that Danziger's lawsuit may once have been legitimate, but it evolved over time into a corporate shakedown. And the judge said that as punishment for that, neither Danziger nor his clients can profit from this fraudulent judgment.
Meantime, decades later, the sludge pools remain in the Ecuadorian jungle. Did the ruling that permitted discovery into the outtakes of the documentary crew, does that affect journalists in other cases from this point forward?
Absolutely. That's a precedent that will potentially haunt especially future documentary filmmakers, because it's simply not that unusual for an activist to, you know, have conversations with the filmmaker and basically try to woo the filmmaker into doing a film. And now that environment, the courts have said, is suspect.
How would you characterize the press's role? Was there misfeasance? Was there malfeasance? Carelessness? What?
I think the problem here was not that people set out to tell the wrong story. They set out to tell the story that they thought they already knew. This case has created all kinds of precedents, not just in the journalistic realm, but also in the legal realm, that are actually going to hurt the causes that Danziger and his colleagues purport to fight for. This is going to make it more difficult to bring these kinds of ambitious transnational human rights cases in the future.
Paul, thank you.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Paul M. Barrett is an assistant managing editor and senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. His new book is titled Law of the Jungle.
Coming up, the stories we tell our children.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, dozens of teachers in Colorado called in sick to protest Jefferson County's conservative school board. The reason? The board is battling the College Board's new Advanced Placement U.S. History Test, taken by hundreds of thousands of high school students each year to improve their college-bound profiles. Conservatives in Colorado and elsewhere are alarmed by what the Republican National Committee called a, quote, radically revisionist view of American history that emphasizes negative aspects of our nation's history. This week, Ben Carson, pediatric neurosurgeon and potential GOP presidential candidate, offered his take on the new AP U.S. history test.
I mean, I think most people, when they finish that course, they'd be ready to go sign up for ISIS. I mean, this is what we're doing to the young people in our nation.
This dispute over a history course has exploded into the education battle of 2014. Leanna Hyten has been covering the conflict for Education Week. She says the first thing we need to do is get our vocabulary straight.
They don't call it a curriculum. They call it a framework, because I guess a curriculum is thought to be a little bit more specific about what teachers should be teaching. Actually, you don't even have to take the course to take the exam. But if you don't take the course and you don't use that framework, you might have a disadvantage when you do get to the exam.
So what was the old AP U.S. history curriculum like, and what's it like now?
The old framework was 5 pages. That was it. It was more like a list than anything else. The major topic would be the crisis of the Union, and under that it might say pro- and anti-slavery arguments and conflicts, and that's about it.
How long is the framework now?
The new framework is about 80 pages long.
What's the impact of going from a 5-page list-like curriculum to an 80-page more specific one? Does that call for more memorization?
Interestingly, it actually calls for less. Teachers would look at the list and think, I have to cover everything here. It was a very mile-wide, inch-deep kind of course. Students felt like they had to memorize everything. They were just given so many facts and timelines. So the idea in changing the course was to make it a bit more deep. So they had fewer topics to study, but they were supposed to study them more deeply.
What about the claim that it besmirches our past? For instance, by suggesting that the justification for the doctrine of manifest destiny was derived in part from a belief in white supremacy. This position endorsed, by the way, by the notoriously leftist historians at the Oxford History of the U.S., but nevertheless, conservatives have objected to linking manifest destiny to a belief in white supremacy. Is this just a kind of rehash of the classic battle between conservatism and academia?
Yeah. And there is a lot of politics going on behind this because in Jefferson County in November 2013, three conservative candidates won, and now they are a majority on the school board. So they are definitely clashing with the supposedly more liberal academics.
The College Board has been working quietly on redesigns of the AP U.S. History test, as well as other AP tests, for about 6 years. In August, a few weeks before the school year began, this issue exploded beyond Jefferson County. In August, the Republican National Committee weighed in. How and why?
The Republican National Committee weighed in and took a vote of no confidence in this framework, saying it's overly negative, it's unpatriotic, all these sorts of things.
If this has been pretty much finished for 2 years, why was it August that the Republican National Committee jumped in, if it were going to jump in at all?
Yeah, it's hard to talk about this without talking about the Common Core state standards.
And by Common Core, you mean
a set of standards that 46 states and the District of Columbia originally agreed to adopt, meaning every student in the state would be taught the same standards, which are really just benchmarks for what students should know and be able to do by the end of the school year. When the College Board rewrote the Advanced Placement U.S. History framework, the College Board says, like, these were written to reflect the Common Core state standards so that students are kind of learning in the same kinds of ways. Previously, states each wrote their own standards, and some states are still using standards that were written internally in the state. President Obama put some incentives in place for states to adopt the Common Core state standards, including states would have a better shot at getting a Race to the Top grant or a waiver from the No Child Left Behind requirements. But nobody was forced to do this.
Colorado hasn't, and Texas hasn't?
Texas hasn't. Colorado has. Texas is one of the four states that never adopted, and they are actually the only state that specifically wrote into state law that they could never adopt the Common Core state standards. Interestingly, last week, the State Board of Education in Texas voted to not use this same AP U.S. history framework that we're talking about. They said it was too negative. They said it was revisionist.
The Texas School Board wrote that materials used to teach history should, quote, promote citizenship, patriotism, essentials and benefits of the free enterprise system, respect for authority. Instructional materials should present positive aspects of the United States and its heritage.
Yes, it's the same thing that's brewing up in Jefferson County as what we saw last week actually happen in the entire state of Texas.
Is it that it's a proxy fight over the culture wars between Democrats and Republicans or conservatives and academia? Is it some sort of opportunity to create a division and alliances before an election? Is this about the children?
We're seeing a confluence of very complicated education issues, including, you know, standards and teacher evaluation and the idea of these national tests that really affect students' futures. These tests are really important for not only college acceptance, but students can get credits based on how well they do on these exams. So all over the country, teachers and students and people in higher ed and everyone is sort of thinking about these issues, and they are causing controversy.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Ultimately, I think tension in education is good because if you're working toward the greater goal of giving students the best education possible, sure, tension's always a good thing. And I think the idea of reviewing a framework that was written by a small group of historians and academics and educators is not a bad thing. Nearly 500,000 students are going to be taking that AP U.S. history exam. So I think it's always good to take it back to the source material. And I'm not a historian myself, so I'm not the best person to look through and say, this is the best way to teach this. These are the best concepts. But we do have historians doing that. And I'm glad to see that.
Leanna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Leanna Hyten is a reporter covering curriculum and instruction for Education Week.
Hey, gosh darn it. It's all about the kids. It's all about molding our young people by indoctrination or by undoctrination. For instance, two-time Pulitzer-winning Washington Post writer Gene Weingarten, an atheist, is fed up with the relentless drumming of religion into the heads of our impressionable youth. So he's just published a book meant to introduce the idea of godlessness to kids. His children's book is called Me and Dog, about the relationship between a young child named Sid and his canine pal, Murphy.
Murphy thinks when things go bad, he must have somehow made me mad. Happy things get understood as his reward for being good. It isn't true. The world is large, and I'm a kid. I'm not in charge. I sometimes think there is no boss, that most things happen just because. Murphy, though, does not agree. He sits around and worships me.
Mm-hmm. So as long as you're going to take the word of there is no God to children, you may as well take a shot at prayer while you're at it. Could you read it for me?
It's silly how he prays and pleads, since I give Murphy all he needs. Because he doesn't want me mad, Murphy tries to not be bad, and he isn't, I admit, except for when he is a bit. I wonder if he'd be as good if Murphy ever understood that I am not the lord and king of absolutely everything. You know, people have read this book and not seen that this was essentially a gentle atheist argument. So this can be read as a parable or it can be read as a narrative. In a narrative, it's just a story about a boy and his dog and something that happens on a walk. And many people are reading it that way. My editor, who I call Tom the Butcher, says that he thinks the title, Me and Dog, is too gentle and that the real title should be There Is No Dog But Dog.
I want to know really what you're about here. Did you write this book to give atheist and agnostic parents a way for their children to look at the world that is not overwrought with religious orthodoxy? Are you just spoiling for a fight with the religious right because you're fed up that religion continues to intrude on secular activities of government and society? What is your goal here?
Well, okay. The book is gentle. And the honest goal is to allow the beginning of a conversation between parents and very young children. But the truth is there is some anger behind it. If you go to Amazon.com and search for children's books and religion, there will be thousands of books, things like How to Teach Zoroastrianism to a 7-Year-Old. There is no end of books about religion for children. If you search for atheism and children's books, there's almost nothing out there. So I wanted to have something out there, but also I wanted to counter something else. Have you ever heard of a book called Heaven is for Real?
Yeah.
It's a huge bestseller by a guy named Todd Burpo, and it was about his son who got sick and went into a coma and believes that he spent some time in heaven conversing with Jesus. And if we're troweling this kind of stuff into the heads of our kids, it's better that they read Me and Dog.
What aspect of this is likely to be most infuriating to the faithful? The idea that you're questioning their faith, one might argue ridiculing it by comparing it to the relationship between a little boy and his dog, or that you are explicitly indoctrinating children to be skeptical of what their parents and clergymen tell them about their religion. Which do you think is going to make people's head explode more?
Actually, I don't think it's that hostile or subversive. And essentially what it's saying is, what if this world of ours is not based on presumptions of magic? What if this world is really what we see is what we get? Would that be so bad? And the book essentially says, no, there is a secular magic in everything around us. The world is beautiful. We have love. We should take care of each other. That is not a frightening concept for any parent to deliver to a child. That's what the book's doing.
You've got kids. They're grown kids now, but what did you tell them about God when they were growing up?
The subject never came up. It was obvious to them that we had no religion. We'd answer any questions directly. You know, some people believe, etc. What happened was when my daughter became of college age, the thing that I would have tried to design happened. She had a curiosity about religion. She hadn't learned about it from us. So in college at the University of Pennsylvania, she became a double major. One was pre-med, and the other was religion. And now she is an agnostic and a veterinarian.
What a perfect audience for me and dog.
There you go.
I understand you say it's gentle, but it looks to me like you are spoiling for a fight. And I'm actually surprised that it has resulted in nary a peep in the religious right, on the conservative media. I'm wondering, what if they held a culture war and nobody came?
Well, with any kind of luck, this show will make that happen.
I suggest prayer. All right, man.
Good talking to you.
Gene Weingarten is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who writes for The Washington Post. His new Me and Dog is on sale now.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovich, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.